Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This year, at least three states put their state-based occupational licensing requirements on the chopping block. Nevada, Ohio, and New Hampshire are all moving toward universal licensing recognition, meaning if you've got an occupational license in something like court reporting, landscape architecture, cosmetology, or cutting hair, and you're in good standing in your home state, those states want to welcome you to move to them, and you won't have to get recertified. Well, over in Boise, Idaho, Teddy Okach says it's about time, especially when it comes to careers in hair care, something she knows a thing or two about.
For as long as I could remember, I grew up around hair, people braiding hair, straightening hair, coloring hair, doing whatever with hair. Hair has always just been a part of who we are.
Teddy is a small business owner now. She was 10 years old when she and her family, refugees from Sudan, first moved to Boise in 2005.
My mom used to pull my hair way too tight and it would hurt for days. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. I want to figure out how to do my own hair. And so I started practicing on myself and I became so good at doing it on myself that I guess a lot of other people started recognizing it and wanted me to do their hair. Our family, when we moved here, we didn't speak any English whatsoever. So after we lived in Idaho for a few years, down the road, we started to realize like, wow, even though we would like to get our hair done, it is very hard to find someone here who knows what to do with Black girls' hair. So in 2008 was when I started getting pretty decent with braiding hair. And so I would put my hair in box braids and then I would walk around and then sometime we'll be at Walmart or something and another Black person would see my hair and they'll be like, oh, wow, I like your hair. Who braided it for you? I just thought they were admiring my hair. So I would just say, yeah, I did it. No way. Would you be willing to do my hair? And I remember it was a really weird question because I was like, I don't even know this stranger. Why do you want me to do your hair? But really, she was just seeking help. Like, hey, I've been in Idaho this long. I can't find anybody to do my hair. I need help. And this lady comes over to do her hair. And me and my sister did this lady's hair. Like, we braided her hair. It looks amazing. And she paid us. And when she paid us, like, it was so shocking. We didn't even know how much to charge her or anything. I legit think that was the first client we probably charged, like, way lower than we should have. Fast forward to 5 years later when it got to the point where I was like, oh, my goodness, like, this business is getting a lot bigger than I'm anticipating. And so that is when my brain was like, what will it take for me to be able to register my business, you know? And that's when I learned that there was no way for me to make my business legal because in order for me to even register my hair business, I had to go to cosmetology school and had cosmetology license. And so that's where things kind of took a turn of like, oh, what do we do now? One night I was just laying there and I was stressing out because I was like, oh my God, like, I don't know, what are we going to do? We have to find a way to make this business legal, but I can't, there's no way. I don't have time to be adding cosmetology school to my budget or my schedule right now. I'm a mom, I'm working full-time, I'm braiding part-time. I don't have an hour out of the day to be going back to school. And so when I stumble across an article and the article says that people in different states were fighting against occupational licenses. We found a group of 10 women that were willing to fight for us. We found a group of supporters and everything. So March of 2022 is when we filed the lawsuit. That was honestly the most uncomfortable time of our lives because we might lose the lawsuit. If we lose the lawsuit, then now you got to shut down your business. But it went really quickly. We were really surprised because by the middle of April, we already heard back that the governor was going to sign a new law in place that would exclude braiding from the cosmetology license, meaning that we no longer had to go to school just to simply braid. It's amazing that it worked out quickly for me, but the question is it going to be as amazing and easy for someone else? There's a way to make an easier option for people, and we don't, and I don't understand why.
That was Teddy Okech of Boise, Idaho. Well, after Idaho's governor got rid of the license requirement for braiding hair, Teddy and her business partner Charlotte got their business registered. They work out of Charlotte's home, and their client list keeps growing. Well, Teddy's story is actually very, very common in the United States because today, one in four American jobs requires an occupational license. That means you, or most likely someone you know, and not just in the legal or healthcare fields. Depending on the state, you could need a license to work as a florist, a private detective, a security guard, or a landscape architect, as New Hampshire Governor Republican Chris Sununu noted in his budget address just this month.
This state doesn't license the contractor who frames your house. But for some reason, we license the guy who's going to put a rose bush out front. Think about that. Not anymore.
Well, the professional boards and state legislatures that issue those licenses say, first of all, about landscape architecture, it's a bit more than just planting roses. And when they think about it, as Governor Sununu urged everyone to do, those professional boards see ample reason for state licensing requirements, things such as safety and consumer protection. So today, we're going to take a look at the massive growth in occupational licensing around the country and why some states are pushing back. And by the way, as I said, this affects one in four American jobs in this country. So if that's you, hop on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio and let us know what you think about your state's licensing requirements, what career you're in, and whether or not you like the requirements or think that it's time to relax them. Again, hop on social media. Facebook or Twitter, we're at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today is Morris Kleiner. He's a professor of public affairs at the University of Minnesota, currently a visiting professor at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and author of many books on occupational licensing. His most recent is Grease or Grit: International Case Studies of Occupational Licensing and Its Effects on Efficiency and Quality. Professor Kleiner, welcome to you.
Well, thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Let's, here on this show, we like to examine the present and the future by first starting with the past. So how old is the idea of occupational licensing in this country?
Well, when you go back to post-Civil War, only about 1% of U.S. workers required permission from government in order to work. And as you mentioned, that number has grown to now 1 in 4. Even after World War II in the 1950s, only 1 in 20 workers required permission from government in order to work. And as you can see, that number and the number of occupations that require licensing has grown dramatically.
So what were the first occupations that required licensing in that post-Civil War era?
Well, some of them are ones you might expect, doctors, lawyers, but also occupations like barbers. And barbers became licensed because they did more than just cut hair during that period. They were also involved in bloodletting. And in fact, the colors on the barber pole were red and white, red for the blood and white for the bandages that they applied following bloodletting. So many occupations have changed in what they do, and barbering required several years of education and training, but their tasks were taken over by the healthcare professions, and what they did was relaxed to where they're now mainly involved in cutting hair, and the requirements have dramatically declined.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so have the licensing requirements, seems like they've always been state-based, even in those early years where there were almost no licenses required. Is that right?
Correct. And as a result of Supreme Court decisions, licensing was devolved to the state level, where in many other countries, licensing takes place at the national level.
Okay. You know, and I want to actually talk with you a little bit later about apt international comparisons that we can learn from. So I'm glad you mentioned that. You've written a whole book about it, Professor Kleiner. But I want to just kind of briefly go through some of your favorite professions that require occupational licenses, because there's like, what, more than 1,000 of them, depending on what state you're in.
Right. And a number of occupations are licensed. For example, in Alabama, drama movement therapists are licensed. In Colorado, rental listing agents are licensed. So that there are a wide variety of occupations, from hawkers and peddlers, athletic agents, soil scientists. All these occupations are licensed in at least one state. And the question is that necessary? And what are the benefits and costs of regulating these occupations?
Yeah. Hawkers and peddlers is one that New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu also pointed out. What does that even mean? What is that? What are those careers? Do you know, Professor Kleiner?
Well, I think they were established many years ago, and these were people who were salespeople, and they wanted to get incompetent or unscrupulous hawkers and peddlers who were selling stuff on the streets off the streets. And as a result, they regulated them. And that's been a key issue in licensing occupations. That is, whenever there are complaints or state legislators see that consumers might be harmed, that's one rationale for licensing occupations. And in fact, that's why doctors and dentists were among the first occupations to be regulated, because of the potential harms that they may cause to consumers.
Yeah. So we're going to talk more about that when we come back from this quick break, about sort of what the reasoning behind the growth in occupational licensing in this country is, and who's really advancing those reasons. So we'll do that in just a moment. Professor Kleiner, hang on here with me. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why 1 in 4 American jobs right now requires some form of occupational licensing, and who that protects, and whether it's actually good or bad for you, the American worker, and of all of us as consumers as well, because some states are pushing back against the whole notion of state-issued occupational licenses. I'm joined today by Morris Kleiner. He's a professor of public affairs at the University of Minnesota and currently visiting professor at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's done a great deal of research about the history and growth in licensing in this country. And Professor Kleiner, you know, just to state the obvious, it makes a lot of sense, right? Just intuitive sense that things like the legal profession, because of the different laws in all of our 50 states, things like healthcare, because of the literal safety knowledge required, and construction trades. I mean, these are all things that you want to have people working in those trades have a certain minimum recognized level of competence, right? But then, and I'm going to give credit to The Atlantic here, we're also living in a world now where they cite that it takes, in Louisiana, for example, it takes $1,400 and more than 2,000 days to become an interior designer. In Kansas, you've got to pay $200 to work as a licensed funeral attendant. In Maine, $235 for the cost of the license and more than 1,000 days of training to become a travel guide. So from your research, Professor Kleiner, who's driving the growth of occupational licenses in fields such as what I just said, interior design, travel, funeral attendance?
Well, it's been two groups. One, certainly the legislators want to protect the public from harms and, again, incompetent or unscrupulous practitioners. But on the other hand, certainly there are members of the occupation, because members of the occupation gain if they're fortunate enough to become licensed. So if they can put barriers to entry, such as education, internships, apprenticeships, continuing education, as conditions for working, that limits the competition, drives up their wages, they can work more hours, and it limits competition for individuals in their occupation. So there's both protecting the public, which is certainly a very important and noble goal, but there's also the monopolies that licensed occupations provide for the practitioners.
It makes them sound more like a guild than anything else.
That's correct. And that's a lot of licensing really evolved from the guilds in Europe and in the United States, that only people who are members of the guild, if you're a member of a particular gender or group or religion, you were a member of the guild. Others couldn't join the guild. And to some extent, that's what's happened in some cases. Certainly that's not allowed legally. But if you put sufficient barriers to entry, education, tuition barriers to entry, all that results in lower income individuals having a much tougher time getting into these occupations relative to people who are well off.
Mm. Well, also, let's recognize, though, that the American economy in 2023 is clearly very different than it was in post-Civil War America or even the 1950s. Is it possible as well that that these careers, I mean, I've been a little tongue-in-cheek here, but let's acknowledge that technology is different. The things that we're asking, court reporters to do, I don't know, or funeral attendants to do, maybe they have become more complex such that additional training is needed, and states are recognizing that the standards just need to be higher, that you can't have someone just fly in and say, well, you know, I saw a couple of YouTube videos, so now I can help a family attend their funeral.
That's one of the things that need to be balanced. So there certainly are trade-offs. One of the trade-offs is, do you limit the number of people who can be in the occupation, which drives up prices, which keeps people from using these services? Certainly, many new occupations have developed in the 1870s or even the 1950s. There were no occupations like genetic counselors, which are moving to become licensed. So there are many new occupations, and many of them tax their members, that is, by dues. They then lobby the legislature and the governor, and then they become licensed. And it is a great benefit to them, but it does preclude individuals from entering the occupation. And the question is, who should choose the persons who are going to provide the services? Is the government a better arbitrator of who should provide these services relative to the consumer? Can organizations who are building contractors decide who is a good electrician, who's a good plumber? So those are things that need to be balanced in terms of occupational licensing, and there certainly are trade-offs relative to consumers and relative to the government in terms of who should decide who can provide these services. And it also results in perhaps reductions in innovations. That is, consumers can see new ways of aluminum piping for a plumber relative to the government saying you only can use copper piping for a particular type of service. So there are all these relatively complex issues that come up with occupational licensing. And the question is, who should decide who can sell these services? Should it be the government or should it be consumers?
Okay. I'm writing down that that dichotomy or that question that you just asked, Professor Kleiner. I'm going to tease listeners here because I want to come back to it, because I think maybe there's a third group that we should keep in mind when thinking about who should decide. But I want to really drill down for a second about one of the main arguments that's presented for the need for licensing, and that was consumer safety that we mentioned before. And it seems like, you know, does the data that we have so far bear out that there are higher levels of health and safety standards that come along with additional licensing? And I note that back in 2015, the Obama White House put out a report, right, a big report about occupational licensing. And in that report, they concluded that, quote, most research does not find that licensing improves quality or public health and safety, and that stricter licensing was associated with quality improvements in only 2 out of 12 of the studies they reviewed at the time. What do you think about that?
I think that's the case, and there have been a number of other studies, mainly in construction, looking at safety. Some work I did on electricians didn't find that tougher regulations reduced injuries for people in that occupation. For consumers, there hasn't been much of an effect on additional requirements with respect to consumer satisfaction or consumer safety. There's work that I've done of Uber drivers, some of whom were licensed, others not, and consumers didn't seem to rate licensed drivers any better than unlicensed ones, and there were no benefits in terms of hard starts or hard stops in the car if someone was a licensed driver or an unlicensed one.
Wait, hang on. Did I hear you correctly? When we're talking about licensed here, we mean driver's licenses or a license to
taxi? Taxi.
Okay.
So individuals, for example, in New York City, in order to be a driver, an Uber driver, a taxi driver, you need to spend quite a bit of money and quite a bit of time to be a licensed taxi driver. You can't pick someone up in New York City unless you're licensed. So that when you look at people who are picked up, for example, at Newark Airport, some of whom are licensed New York City drivers, some are unlicensed New Jersey drivers, and then you look at the rankings of the drivers, and Uber also takes great care to measure safety through hard starts and hard stops. There were really no differences in the quality that was delivered to the consumer for a licensed versus unlicensed driver.
Okay. So that leads us to the question of whether, the occupations that are requiring licenses that aren't proving to be more safe, in terms of licensing, making them more safe, like what's actually going on here? And you spoke a little earlier about barriers to entry, Professor Kleiner. And it's what's fascinating is that the Institute for Justice, which has been advocating very strenuously against occupational licensing for some time, they looked at some 71 occupations, including barbering and beauty occupations. And according to them, they found that those occupations faced greater average burdens for entry level to enter those fields than even emergency medical technicians. So let's keep in mind the idea of the beauty industry, because earlier in the show, we heard from Teddy Oketch, the hair braider in Boise, Idaho. Now, she mentioned her business partner, Charlotte. That's Charlotte Omosu. And the thing about Charlotte is that it wasn't that she didn't have a license to braid hair. She did, except it wasn't in Idaho.
My business partner, for one, she came to the U.S. when she was a little older. She got a cosmetology license back in Africa. And when she moved into the U.S., they let her use that license when she was working in a salon in Boston. And so for her to work in a salon in Boston and move to Idaho, and Idaho is telling her she can't transfer her Boston license to Idaho, it's like, what are you talking about? I didn't just forget my skills because my license is all of a sudden in another state. That doesn't even make any sense.
And again, just to remind you, Teddy and other hair braiders managed to convince the Idaho state government to change the rules there and not require licenses for hair braiding. So this brings us into the issue of what's known as universal recognition, or states that are saying, hey, we're going to recognize a license that was earned in, you know, a different state, and as long as you're in good standing, come on over and work for us. And one of those, as I mentioned earlier in the show, is Ohio. And joining us now from Napoleon, Ohio, is Rob McCulley. He's a Republican in the Ohio State Senate and majority floor leader of the state Senate, and was the prime sponsor of a new law in Ohio that universalizes occupational licensing. It takes effect on April 3rd. Senator McCulley, welcome to you.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what state occupational licensing looked like in Ohio before this new law was signed.
Well, like many states, it's been a regime that's been put in place over the course of years, and Dr. Kleiner hit on it spot on, where over the course of time, either through the purpose of helping out the public safety, or through the purpose of, trying to say that, this is something that should be licensed because of the type of work they're doing. We really allowed the regime and the bloat in the licensing agencies to grow. And especially in a state, I would say that has term limits. And so you have turnover of legislators. The institutional memory fades after a while. And so there's not as much of a focus on, well, we've done an awful lot of this over the course of time. Maybe we need to take a critical look at it, which is something we have started to do over the last 4 or 5 years.
Mm. And so then what specifically did this new law change in Ohio? Is it universal recognition for, I don't know, how many currently licensed occupations there?
So it's universal recognition across the board that if you have a license in another state, and that license is in good standing, you know, you've paid your fees, you don't have a criminal or disciplinary history with that license, that, and I think Teddy Okech said it the best, your skills don't go away as soon as you cross the border. And we needed to recognize that if there are other states, even if they have less stringent requirements than the state of Ohio, if there are other states that have these licenses and they're not seeing a variety of terrible and unfortunate circumstances arise because of those less stringent requirements, then maybe we need to say, well, that's good enough for the state of Ohio too. These people should be able to come in and set up a business or earn a living while they're here.
And does this include things like lawyers, healthcare careers?
So it includes healthcare careers. It includes everything from your doctor all the way down to some of the more, lesser training required for certain licenses. It's across the board, with exception to one, lawyers. And that was in large part because our state constitution delegates the governance of the practice of law exclusively to the Supreme Court. And so we were unable to include lawyers in the licensing legislation.
So even medical and healthcare jobs, because that's one area in which, for example, Governor Chris Sununu in New Hampshire, he wants to, they haven't done it yet. This is his proposal that came out of his budget address earlier this month. You know, he says he wants New Hampshire to eliminate or have universal recognition for licenses in things like sonography or nuclear medicine technologists, radiography, even CT scanning. That's received quite a bit of pushback because of, again, concerns about qualification and patient safety. How did you address those in Ohio?
Again, we went in, it's a mindset. We went in knowing that we were going to be broad with very little exception or carve out built in. In fact, nobody was going to be specifically carved out other than the lawyers, which I mentioned before, because our hands were tied on that. But and we made that clear to everybody. We made it clear to the industry. We made it clear to the administrative state that's overseeing these licensing regimes. We made it clear to all of them, there will be no carve-outs, and this will be something that will broadly be applicable. And in fairness, our Lieutenant Governor John Husted and Governor Mike DeWine were also supportive of this concept that we would have universal recognition across the board. And so that we had everybody really singing from the same page of the hymnal, so to speak, as far as the governor is concerned, the legislature is concerned, to realize that this is a priority. If there are minor issues that should be tweaked, for example, Ohio may be part of a reciprocal arrangement with another state where that reciprocity agreement may be affected if you let in another licensee from another state that's not part of that reciprocal arrangement. We address that by saying that the licensing board can prohibit that individual from participating in the reciprocity agreement.
Senator McCauley, can you just hang on here for a quick second? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just we got to take a quick break, and I've got one more question for you on the other side of that break. So stand by, and Professor Kleiner, hang in there as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the growing pushback from some states when it comes to occupational licensing. And I'm joined today by Morris Kleiner. He's a professor of public affairs at the University of Minnesota. He's currently at Stanford University. And Senator Rob McCauley joins us. He's a Republican state senator from Ohio and the majority floor leader there, who was recently a prime sponsor of a new law signed in January by Governor Mike DeWine that universalizes occupational licensing, or recognizes occupational licenses earned outside of Ohio. Now, Senator McCauley, I just want to clarify one thing, because we're getting some comment online here from folks saying, oh, are we really saying we don't need licensed electricians and plumbers? Can anybody say they can work on wires in your house? No, thanks. To be clear, that's not what Ohio has passed, right? We're talking about recognizing licenses from any other state. Is that right?
That's correct. We didn't eliminate any licenses in this bill. In fact, that was in order to even participate in this new program that was authorized under the bill, you have to have had a license in another state.
Okay. Now, a little earlier in the show, Professor Kleiner laid out the some evidence that shows that the trade groups and industries in which we've seen the biggest growth of licensing requirements, that one of the reasons why they may do it is the barriers to entry protect people who are already inside those occupations, and the idea is that it reduces competition and holds up their wages. So therefore, I wonder, you know, nothing just happens overnight so easily in state legislatures. Did you receive any pushback from different trade groups in Ohio?
We did. We received some pushback. Several groups that wanted to be completely excluded from the new legislation. Several groups that wanted it to be handled a little bit differently. For example, we did come up with a different process by which to bring the building trades into this bill. which is something that's unique in Ohio compared to other states. A lot of other states exempted the building trades altogether. But we had to work with them, given some of the uniqueness of their challenges, and what they're going through, to come up with a new process altogether. We had some other groups that wanted to be completely exempted because they thought being included in the bill would hurt some federal protections that they have, which to me made absolutely no sense, given the fact that other states have brought some of these groups in through reciprocity arrangements and through universal recognition. So we did get some of that pushback.
Okay. And just to be clear, did you get pushback also from, say, schools, where people would have to go to school to be qualified to even apply for a license? I mean, I know this is quite common in things like cosmetology.
Yeah, we did get some pushback from some of them. For the most part, though, their pushback was smaller than some of the other groups. And, you know, really, you got to kind of look at when these licenses are enacted, who has the vested interest in these things being enacted? And Dr. Kleiner touched on it as well. Sometimes it's the industry. It's the licensed professionals themselves who want to create a barrier around themselves to entry from potential outside competition. But also, you also touched on it, sometimes it's the educators who have a cottage industry whereby they're going to be able to make an entire business surrounding training licensees that's outside of your traditional education model.
Mm. Well, Rob McCulley, Republican Ohio State Senator and Majority Floor Leader in the state of Ohio. And by the way, I should note that, again, Governor Mike DeWine signed this universal licensing recognition law into effect in Ohio in January. So, Senator McCulley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna.
Professor Kleiner, you know, one of the things that we heard from Ohio and Governor Kristi Noem in New Hampshire was saying it loud and clear was, hey, one of the reasons we want to do this is to get more people to come and live in our states. And we got to reduce the barriers for people who may want to move to New Hampshire or Ohio. What evidence is there that occupational licensing either is or isn't a barrier to people moving from state to state in this country?
Well, some work that I've done with a colleague at Minnesota, Jana Johnson, looked at tougher or more relaxed licensing requirements, and we found that more relaxed requirements mattered in terms of the ability to move across state lines. So the example you gave earlier with respect to cosmetology, that applies across many other occupations, and especially school teachers, where it's much more difficult to move across state lines based on the occupational licensing requirements. And what's happened, and this began in Arizona with Governor Ducey, although this has become a nonpartisan issue, Governor Polis in Colorado and Governor Shapiro in Pennsylvania have also dramatically reduced the requirements to move across state lines. And what you mentioned was universal recognition. So the ability to make the occupational licensing not be a barrier to entry and really be grease in the how labor markets work, that is, make labor markets reduce friction, is an important part of what many governors are doing, including the 19 states that the Institute for Justice has noted have introduced some form of universal recognition.
Mm. Well, just to buttress what you're saying, again, I'm looking back at this 2015 analysis from the Obama White House, and they found that interstate migration rates for workers in fields that have a lot of licensing requirements were lower than for those in the least licensed occupations. So a little bit of additional data there. Now, listen, we are getting a ton of comments online here, Professor Kleiner. Rosemary tells us on Twitter that Rosemary's spouse is a K-12 educator. They've moved across state lines a couple of times. He's had to pay to get recertified every time. Massachusetts made him take and pay for an instruction for English language learners exam, even though he had just passed it in California, and the test was the same. Someone from calling themselves Connect Connecticut says professional licensing also presents a huge barrier to employment. For people with criminal records, for example, state include blanket bans on licenses for people with a conviction on their record, even if it's decades old. On the other hand, DC LEDs tells us, I have an LED business and having a license for anything makes you legit and recognizable in the world. I wonder if you want to just comment on that quickly, Professor Kleiner, about sort of the way it presents that worker to their potential clients.
Well, I think that's very important. When you go to a party or meet somebody for the first time, you don't ask them how much money you make. But you do ask them what they do. So if you are a dentist, an electrician, part of your identity is involved in your occupation. So that protecting the quality of that occupation is important. And you certainly see the occupations, as was mentioned by the senator, try to push back whenever there's an attempt to introduce universal recognition or attempts to reduce or limit the licensing of these occupations. And certainly in New Hampshire, I would expect many of the licensed occupations to push back as their attempts to either relax or eliminate the requirements to enter and work in these occupations.
Mm. Well, and they are actually already receiving that pushback. On New Hampshire Public Radio, Karen Bennett, who's a retired forester who helped set up the licensing process for forestry, which is one of the things potentially on the chopping block there, said that taking care of forests just isn't about cutting trees and removing a commodity. It's about taking care of a very complex system. And so you need professionals that are educated, experienced, and held to a standard. That's from New Hampshire there. Now, you had said earlier, Professor, that the trade boards really are one of the driving factors in the increase in the number of occupations that require licensing. And I'm seeing here that there was a paper from the American Economic Association that looked at requirements from 1870, as we said, post-Civil War to 2020, and found that the formation of state-level professional associations, which facilitate political organization, increases the probability of regulation by approximately 15 percentage points in the first 5 years of those associations' establishments. So we did want to hear, obviously, from trade groups this hour, because they are some of the biggest proponents out there of licensing. So we spoke to the Associated Builders and Contractors, or ABC. They're a national U.S. trade association that represents the non-union construction industry.
We like to say it, you can stay in it, pray in it, play in it, or heal in it. Our members build those things. And if you can refine it, manufacture, or distribute it, our members build those things.
This is Greg Sizemore, Vice President of Health, Safety, Environment, and Workforce Development at ABC. Now, most of their members have to have a license to work, and Sizemore says he wants to keep it that way.
When we begin to think about contractors and craft professionals in our industry, we don't need help talking about the incidences that happen on job sites across America that end in a fatality. We don't need the help to talk about these incidences where something collapses or whatever. Those things, everybody knows those things. What we need is the help to make sure these don't happen. And that really becomes what that licensing and or credential, you know, it kind of sets in stakes in place. It says here, at the end of the day, these individuals are competent to do their job. They have the skills and the knowledge and the abilities to do their work. So while on the one hand, we want to keep that to a measurable minimal requirement, we don't want to lower that bar so more people can make it. We want to keep it high so we can keep America safe.
Now, as more states seek to enact universal licensing recognition, Sizemore says ABC is not against it, but thinks there needs to be some guardrails in place.
Universal sounds like we're painting with a very broad brush and that anybody can get in. Our organization supports fair opportunities for these contractors to work in your state. Fair being, don't set the bar so high that it's going to take me forever to meet it. What is different about your state that I need to know so that I can come in here and do the work? And so what we're trying to do is there's a balance between the license and the time, and there should be reciprocity equal, with the exception of the local circumstances that, you know, determine the building code in those respective areas.
So that's Greg Sizemore, Vice President of Health, Safety, Environment, and Workforce Development of the Associated Builders and Contractors, a large construction trade group. You know, Professor Kleiner, a little earlier, you had said one of the main questions here that we're faced with is who's better at deciding, right? Is government better than the consumer in sort of deciding what standards there should be or what occupations are in need of some form of licensing? And I wonder if maybe we should think about it in a different way. And I'm going to credit Jerusalem Demsis from The Atlantic for this framework, in that right now what we have largely is trade groups deciding. Because, in fact, maybe, you know, for the past 40 or 50 years, we've slowly just eroded government's ability to make smart, consumer-friendly safety decisions. And so the trade groups have stepped in instead. And we actually have a system now that's largely been driven by the private sector. So is there a way to remedy that, that maybe what we actually need is potentially more government regulatory expertise that might reduce the need for trade group certified licensing?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. My colleague here at Stanford, Peter Blair, has been looking at this issue with respect to data he got from Angie. And consumers really aren't willing to pay more for licensed service. But he found, along with his colleague, was that it reduced employment. And when you reduce employment and the number of people in the occupation, that tends to raise prices so that individuals, rather than going to someone who they know is competent, will have a low-cost provider, your brother-in-law, for example, who might do the plumbing or do the electrical work with perhaps disastrous consequences. So one needs to look at who's providing these services and what the effect of the services are on overall quality, not just what I would call point of sale services. So even though a highly skilled electrician, plumber does a terrific job, but the cost of those services keeps people from hiring them.
Mm-hmm.
And that might lead to overall a reduction in quality. And certainly, as you mentioned, one of the key factors in the evolution or the origins of licensing were the trade groups. They formed associations, and where you see an association being formed, there was a dramatically higher possibility of that occupation becoming licensed. And this was true from nursing to physical therapists to many other occupations. Yeah. That when the associations were formed, they lobbied the legislature, the governor, to introduce licensing, and over time, perhaps even more importantly, ratchet up the requirements. So accountants went from 4 to 5 years, physical therapists went from bachelor's to now doctor of physical therapy. Hmm. So you see not just the entry, but the evolution of these practices.
Okay, so we have 15 seconds, Professor Kleiner, but I want to give you a shot at describing, is there a less restrictive way to still hold up public safety?
Yes, certainly markets, there's bonding, there's certification. All those ways provide less restrictive and less monopolistic ways of providing services and ensuring quality to consumers.
Well, Morris Kleiner, professor of public affairs at the University of Minnesota, currently a visiting professor at Stanford University and author of many books on occupational licensing. His latest is Grease or Grit: International Case Studies of Occupational Licensing and Its Effect on Efficiency and Quality. I do have to apologize, Professor Kleiner. We didn't get a chance to talk about those international examples, but maybe we'll do it again sometime in the future. But thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.